Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 2:16 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and that's on September 2nd. I thought we'd kick off with UK gilts. They've broken on the upside, and well, we can definitely now say that it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So this is important. It is calling into question the secular trend. And this has been going down for a long time. So there has been an example in the past where we've had these higher highs. They've all been quickly countermanded. So it's not beyond hope just yet, but certainly this has been an awfully big move. And when we flick it around and just look at a candlestick chart, well, we can clearly see that the downtrend has been broken. And if we put some big moving averages on there, then we're also going to see that there have been plenty of occasions when the yield has been able to get above the 200-day and 1,000-day moving averages, but it has always failed. And on this occasion, it hasn't just pulled away from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, but the 200-day moving average has crossed up and through it. So maybe if we put this onto a monthly chart, we can see it a little better. There have been very few occasions when the 200-day was above the 1,000-day moving average, but this is certainly one of them, and the yield continues to march higher. We're right in the region of the peaks from back in 2013, and 3% is a big psychological level, but there's no sign of it slowing down just yet. So then let's think about the pound. One thing that I'm rather reminded by is the minimum wage. So minimum wages for people in their mid-20s in the UK are somewhere around £9.20. And that's quite a bit lower than what we have, for example, in California, where the minimum wage is $15. And of course, that doesn't really matter when there's a wide currency differential. But the pound is coming down rather hard against the dollar. We're down to about 115. It's clearly broken down from this most recent range. It's been coming down now for quite a long time, and there's no real sign yet that this decline is over. So obviously we're coming back into the region of the lows from all the way back, and I can't quite see the days there, but it's in the 1980s. And obviously that could potentially be a point of support. But what it is also very clearly highlighting is that the UK economy is derating, which is obviously a negative for the living standards, where interest rates are ramping higher. And then of course we have this exceptional inflation in natural gas prices. So natural gas has really just been going straight up. Now it definitely came back this week, but not sufficiently to unwind all of the prior acceleration. And then Gazprom came out today and said that they are shutting down, or well, I guess it's already shut down, so they're not going to open up the Nord Stream pipeline again. So they are responding to the success that Europe has had in building up supply storages, and they're going to make it as difficult as possible for Europe to get through the winter. But Germany in particular has been investing in floating regasification units, and by the time they get to the end of 2023, they'll have upwards of a third of their natural gas supply coming through from those LNG terminals. So that's really That's a very significant development. But it's not going to preserve the risk in the economy in the winter of 2022. And Russia has got a clear interest in trying to make as much of its energy weapon as it can before Europe or Western Europe has the opportunity to circumvent reliance on Russian oil. Now, there's a lot of talk going on right now about the potential for a cap on Russian oil prices. And I think that's rather interesting. The only possible way that they could do something like that is if they succeed in telling insurance companies that they're not allowed to insure the shipping industry. Well, we can see oil prices have now broken down through the $100 level. We're down around $93. The Russian oil price is already trading at a discount of about $20 to Brent. So that would suggest that Russia's price is already around 70. One thing that the UK has is a dominance of the Lloyd's group of insurance companies really dominates the big insurance policies around the world for exogenous events and the reinsurance market. So by flexing that dominance, they could prevail upon the shipping industry not to ship Russian oil unless it was locked in at a lower price. And then, of course, Europe also has dominance of the global shipping industry. So then Europe has another economic weapon to combine with the insurance program. So then we should think about that's what the weapon is. What's the countermeasure? Just like Europe has been able to find floating regasification and has been indiscriminately buying natural gas to flood their storage facilities, well, then Russia would probably prevail upon China, which also has a large shipping fleet and large insurance companies. So they might go off and say to a company like Ping An, well, why don't you engage in the reinsurance business? So this kind of tit for tat is only going to push Russia and China closer together. But of course, China then has the additional challenges of what are they going to do with their financial sector and their property sectors? Because Ping An Insurance is trending downwards, and it was at a new low in here today. And this has been a really quite profound decline. We're talking about a share coming down from well in excess of 100 to around 45 in the space of little more than a year. Then let's just think about Country Garden. This is a major property developer, and it's down from 18 to 217 in the space of the last 4 years, and it's accelerating lower. So obviously accelerating is a trend ending, and it will end if it gets to zero. The big challenge here is a similar challenge to the government-dominated sector that India had back in 2018. So if we look at, for example, I'm not sure if we still have Dewan financing, and it's not in our chart library anymore, so maybe we can find it on Bloomberg. But Dewan was a housing finance company that's now basically disappeared, and I do wonder whether it's now going well. We can see, I guess I'm just following this train of thought. Maybe we could get the old price. So this one, Piramal Enterprises, collapsed in 2020, but we can certainly see the decline in Yes Bank as indicative of the pressure that we had in the housing finance sector in India in 2018, and I guess in 2019 too. So this was a bank trading for 400 that came down to about 10, and phenomenal speculation about whether it was going to go bust. And arguably, it's been rescued from going bust, but it could be in a very prolonged bear market because there's no real support for private home lending. Whereas State Bank of India, well, it went through 2018 and 19 with a bit of a wobble around the middle of 2019, but then rebounded, had a bit of a wobble again in 2020, and now it's on the cusp of breaking out to new all-time highs. This is a great example of the difference between a state-sponsored bank and a private bank in an environment where there is a liquidity crisis. And let's just think about that for China. There's a large number of privately owned property companies in listed in Hong Kong and on the mainland, and the chances are that a good number of those are going to go bust. We can also then look at China Vanke, and this is about as close to the property sector royalty as one can imagine. And the share is steadying from the region of the lows earlier this year. The most important point, of course, is that it's not accelerating lower. So there is the potential here that what we're going to see in China is a recalibration of the property sector around state-owned companies or state-sponsored companies, or at a very minimum, very well-connected private companies, which is basically state-owned without actually having the moniker. So those are the companies that are likely to survive. The rest will probably go bust. Property prices are under pressure, and we have legions of people that paid up for houses and now can't live in them because they're in various stages of construction, which is another word for disrepair. So it's going to create social pressures, and certainly there's nothing like losing your entire life savings on a property speculation, something that you believed was not a speculation at all, that tends to sour people on the dream of the iron rice bowl. And that really is a thing of the past now in China. So the government has a choice. They could nationalize the property sector, or more likely, they'll recapitalize the state-owned portion of the property developer sector, and they'll finish some of these projects. But the problem with that is that, and certainly we can see right now that the renminbi has been trending downwards, and it's paused over the last few days. But the devaluation of the currency would be certainly a portion of the solution to China's problem because they can devalue the currency, they can use some of that cash to then support the property sector and the banking sector. It's very likely that nationalization is going to be the solution, but the big challenge for that is that it's going to rob the credit system of the credit multiplier from the property sector. So the banks are really weak right now, and the A600 banks index is right in the region of the lows from over the last 7 years. Now, I think this is, you might think that this is all an esoteric type of discussion, but what happens with China's liquidity is going to have global repercussions. If we look at the USA, they are tightening interest rates and bond yields are ramping higher, and there's a real inflation pressure. Well, China avoided the inflation pressures because they didn't print money like it was going out of fashion in 2020, and mostly because they didn't have to. exports boomed, and by virtue of their lockdowns and basically keeping people in place in the factories, they were able to crank up their manufacturing. And even though there have been there back in 2020, we had different supply chain issues than we have today. And the primary issue in 2020 was trying to keep up with all the orders. So China didn't need to stimulate the economy because it benefited enormously from everywhere else stimulating and trying to supply enough of equipment and PPE accessories to the rest of the world was a major fillip for the Chinese economy. So now the rest of the world is dealing with the inflationary pressures, and China is going through its own difficulties. Now, if China stimulates, then that's going to fuel the inflationary pressures because it's going to start mopping up any available commodities around the world. And those will be used to fuel an infrastructure-led boom. If they don't inject the volume of liquidity that they have done during other rescue plans, well, then the inflationary pressures around the world won't be quite as intense. And I think the two big barometers of that will be copper and oil. So copper prices have broken downwards and now this week are pulling back in a violent manner from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And let's just also look at that on a log scale chart, or not a log scale, excuse me, a point and figure chart, and with plenty of back history. So we can see this exceptionally lengthy range and the beautiful consistency of prior bull market. And we had the clear break on the upside. We had a loss of consistency. We had a failed upside break, then a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We've had a little rebound, and now the price is rolling over once more. So it's a completed type 2 top formation, and it's a failed break out of this long range. So there is the clear potential that prices are going to come all the way back down to the lower side of the range. And that's nearly 10,000 points. So I'm rather upset with myself that I didn't jump back in on my short position, but most of my other short positions are working out fine. So when we look at this chart, it does not signal bull market. Now, I think this is exceptionally important because I remember being at the Future Minerals Summit in Riyadh in January. And you had Robert Friedland and the CEO of Barrick talking about a massive new secular bull market in commodities. And that has been the rallying call for the energy sector, for the mining sector, for most of the last 2 years. That governments everywhere are changing the laws, they are greatly enhancing the attractiveness of electric vehicles, and that this is an inevitable trend. There's going to be a huge growth in the uptake of electric vehicles. There are battery factories being built left and right, and we're going to need at least 50 new large-scale lithium mines to come even close to meeting the demand outlook, that the volume of copper that will be required to meet the growth projections of the renewable energy sector between now and 2030 is a doubling of global supply. And there's just no way that those mines are going to be built. When we think about the governmental, social, and geographical, monetary, capital challenges And not to mention geological challenges. We are talking about mining after all, that come with building new copper mines and new lithium mines. And the volume of new mines that need to be created, the amount of money that would need to be raised against a background where raising any money at all for extractive industries is a hard sell. And then with rising geopolitical tensions, it's exceptionally difficult to envisage a world where any of that mining infrastructure is in fact going to be built. So then the question is, are we looking instead at what's a circular argument that we're going to have a big bull market in commodities because they will have to buy the commodities that are available to build all of these batteries. And we can't build new mines, so there's going to be a supply and elasticity argument. Well, the only way that a consumer is going to get around the rising cost of batteries would be to raise the price, and then people aren't going to be able to afford to buy them. So then you are relying on government subsidies to overwhelm the inflationary pressures from commodity prices. So that's expensive. So there's the alternative that maybe these companies are really ingenious and they slay the challenges that come from the battery chemistry, something that they have failed to do for the last decade, and that's going to be something that will reduce the demand for commodities. But how can you have a commodity bull market if the companies that you're selling to use less of what you're selling? So these are really difficult questions. But the most important thing is that there's an exceptional amount of hype around this whole topic, and both copper and oil are trending down. So this instead is looking more like an impending recession. And higher interest rates overall, well, they make speculative decisions about what to invest in much more pressing, and fiscal responsibility becomes much more important. So I think these are really significant issues that we have these incredible promises. And of course, the thing is about big bull markets. We get huge bull markets because of big promises. And everybody gets exceptionally enthused about the future, which is going to be completely different from the past, where the future is going to be so bright and so promising, and all we need to do is buy, and everything else will take care of itself. We can go back and think about the massive challenges that come after bubbles burst. Let's just think about the Nasdaq. We've had a really exceptional bull market, and I'm going to get as much history as I can. And because prices are so far away today from where they were back in 1999, then it doesn't look like anything. But one thing that we can say for certain is that using 50 years of data, we've had an exceptional acceleration, and now the price is rolling over. And in fact, this is a consistent downtrend. The size of the rebound, this most recent rebound, was a little bit larger, but it only just pushed up into the overhead trading range, and then it's rolling over once more. So this is a consistent downtrend. Now, if we look at this on a monthly basis, we can see that we had this huge acceleration in the 1990s, and there were massive promises. This was the dawn of the internet. And The disintermediation was the buzzword of the day, that by going online, you could disrupt the brick and mortar companies, and that it was the online companies were going to be the true success stories. And that story was true. That's exactly what happened. And Amazon has become one of the biggest companies in the world by disintermediating large numbers of brick and mortar companies. And it's only by virtue of those brick and mortar companies also adopting online strategies that they've been able to survive at all. And some of the other promises made in the 1990s were that biotechnology is exceptionally important, that we have just sequenced, or we're on the cusp of sequencing the human genome for the first time. That actually was completed after the market peaked. And lots of biotech companies were really surging in value at the time. And it was by virtue of the rapid prototyping and rapid genetic sequencing that we were able to come up with vaccines for the coronavirus in record time. Historically, it's taken 3 years to come up with a vaccine, and Moderna had a candidate vaccine in human trials within 6 weeks of getting the genome. Now, it doesn't matter how one feels about vaccines or the mandates or anything else that's happened. That's exceptional in terms of the technology involved. But the promise for it was in 1999, and the reality was in 2020. So today, let's think about what are the big promises being made. Well, the first big promise is for electric vehicles, and that within the next 5 years, the number of electric vehicles on the road is going to balloon. So nobody is answering the question, where is the electricity going to come from? And we've had, every time I open the app to control my AC at home, over the last few days, I've had a pop-up asking me if I'm willing to allow the utility to take control of it, to try and control or put the heat up when they need to, and I don't like that. But the reality is that even an energy-rich place like an energy-rich and friendly place like Texas is struggling to balance its power grid. And unseasonably warm weather in California is risking blackouts over the next couple of days. So California is not an energy-friendly location and relies instead on importing electricity from its neighbors. And all of its neighbors are also experiencing a heat wave right now. So this is problematic. Where is the electricity going to come from? Well, there are utilities that are investing heavily. Oh, golly, that's not looking like the right chart. So NextEra is investing heavily in solar and wind, and they have nuclear reactors. So that's held up better. It's also trading with a substantial loss. So they are investing heavily in additional new supply, so you've got negative free cash flow of about 8 billion and debt of about 63 billion. So they are running a levered portfolio. They are trying to invest as heavily as they can to gain market share because they believe that the government has got their back and that there's going to be a lot more support for green energy going forward, which is probably not a bad business model. And the big question then is, Is there scale in batteries? Because it doesn't matter how efficient the solar panel is or how large the wind turbine is, they're still going to be intermittent sources of energy. And I find it particularly interesting that despite the Inflation Reduction Act, the global wind sector was down in a dynamic manner in here today, or this week. And the solar ETF is testing the upper side of the underlying range. So rising interest rates are really difficult for speculative ventures to thrive in. And it's at the Brookfield Renewable Partners. They were able to buy out the utility scale solar panels from bankruptcy. So they got them cheap and they have cash flows. So that's holding up better. But it hasn't gone anywhere for over a year. And there is an upward bias to trading, but it's not going anywhere. So when we think then about these promises, we can probably think that the promises will come true because that's what happens in bull markets. Major bull markets make big promises, and those promises come true. But that does not mean that the price goes up in a straight line. So there is the realistic possibility that we are looking at a are the beginning of a difficult period for asset prices. Then let's think about Tesla. So Tesla is the electric vehicle company, and it's able to sustain this business model because it's the electric vehicle company, and it's got a market cap of 845 billion. And the estimated PE is now down to about 65, which is racy, but it's not as racy as it used to be. And a lot of the valuation is based upon the fact that they've succeeded in getting to mass production. Now, let's just think about the share price. Maybe it's better to put it on a logarithmic scale chart. We can see the long ranges. And particularly if we go back some period in time. So it popped on the upside in 2013 because people started buying the Roadster. And then it went sideways, and albeit in a 100% range from 10 to 20, but went sideways for the next 6 years. And during that time, it was building its battery factories. And then when the Model 3 was released, then the share multiplied and it went from 20 to 200. Now we're going sideways, and the price has basically been ranging between 2 and 400 for the last 18 months. And there is a clear downward bias to trading over the course of the last year. This is potentially top formation development because the valuation implies that Tesla is going to be selling every vehicle, and that's unlikely. Then the valuation implies that autonomy is going to be a major feature of new Tesla vehicles any day now. But the history of innovation and the history of big promises being made during significant bull markets, well, that suggests that it could be quite a bit longer before we actually get to autonomy. And it might not be Tesla that provides it. So these are significant factors because of the downward bias to trading. Now, I think it's especially important to just look at the performance of those eight shares. The big Fangman plus Tesla shares. So that is Facebook, Apple, Nvidia, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Netflix, and Tesla. And we have a really beautifully consistent downtrend. And we have a series of ranges, one below the last. And now it's pulling back from a market cap of 10 trillion. We're at 9 trillion. We used to be at 12 trillion. So this index has lost a third of its value, and it is still trending downwards in a consistent manner. So we're at a really important juncture here. Big promises have been made. The companies that, I guess, personify those promises did exceptionally well in 2020 and 2021 when liquidity was hugely available. Now they're rolling over. So, is this the top or is it a top? And I think this is the most important question in the market today. And I want to go back and look at the Nasdaq 100 in 1998 as an example. So we had a good sized wobble in 1998, and it looks like absolutely nothing on this chart. We saw the price pull back from about 1,300 and 70 to 1,050. So the market pulled back by about 30%, did not break the uptrend, and after that went up five times. So that was a huge move. And in 1998, it was the Russian debt default and long-term capital management. And the Federal Reserve did a whip around and they rescued at the financial markets by hugely increasing the amount of liquidity available. And around the same time, there were fears about Y2K. There was a massive investment cycle in the semiconductors sector because everyone thought that they had to replace their communications equipment and their computers before the year 2000. So we had this enormous investment in new gear, a huge investment in new manufacturing capacity for chips. And all fueled by money that had been created in response to the long-term capital management bailout. And the price of stocks went massively higher. But then we also started to see interest rates rising, and they continued to rise all the way through 2000. And the most levered portions of the market rolled over first, and then they took the rest of the market with them. Well, then let's think about that just in at what we have had recently, because it looks very similar. We had a significant pullback in 2020, and just on the log scale chart, you can barely see it. And subsequently, the price went from approximately 6,900 to 16,000. So it's not a five times acceleration like we had in 2000. But it was a massive acceleration. The index more than doubled in the space of 18 months. And now we have higher interest rates and central banks that are worried about inflation. And primarily, they're worried about inflation because they got it so wrong a year ago. They thought inflation would be transitory, and it has not been transitory. So we're at a critical juncture. I was thinking at the beginning of the year that the fiscal challenges would be too much for central banks to raise interest rates into. But I greatly underestimated the lead time between when interest rates go up and when the real fiscal problems start. So it's not like that's not going to be the case, but there is a significant lag between when interest rates rise and when the downward pressure starts to come on government coffers. One thing that's been a particular factor of the USA this year has been the swelling of both state and federal coffers with tax receipts because of the strength of consumer spending and also a good measure of inflation, with prices rising, then sales taxes, a percentage of that has also been very clearly rising. So they're going to continue to raise interest rates. If they persist, it's going to put downward pressure on stocks, and it will have the greatest effect on the most levered plays. And that's already evident in the poor performance of the ARK Innovation ETFs over the last 18 months. So that ETF has collapsed in value, lost 75% in a year, popped on the upside, and then came straight back down. So this is a clear example that the vacuum of supply above the market had not formed, and the people who had held the whole way down used the short flurry of bullish activity to let their inventory go, and prices are right back down close to the lows. The other big promise, a phenomenally large promise of the last 14 years, has been Bitcoin. So Bitcoin prices today are back below 20,000. Now, there are a couple of, I think, points to be made. The first is the promise. The promise is decentralized finance. And there are unique characteristics to decentralized finance that unlock availability of credit in a fashion that's never been possible before. So that is something that will last. There is always going to be a push and pull between the holders of capital and those that want to access it in order to grow. And how do those people or those various sides of the market meet one another? And how do they access capital? So I think it is quite likely we're going to see a much greater role for private capital in the future. It also suggests that perhaps the stock market is going to be less relevant. When we think about Bitcoin, it's a private asset. It's not pioneered by institutions. It's been championed by retail investors, and its institutions have got in more recently. But the value of the token is in no way going to support or detract from the fundamental argument about decentralized finance. The big promise is that it's going to enable people to find one another, that you'll be able to come up with an idea and be able to find funding to help you grow it in an easier manner in future than you have in the past. And you'll be able to tokenize shares in whatever your idea is and be able to distribute returns in an equitable manner. And the no trust, decentralized nature of the market, that's where the promise lies. And you have teams of people all over the world attempting to fulfill it. It in no way has anything to do with the significant advance that we've seen in the price of Bitcoin and then subsequently the big declines. I continue to believe that the price of Bitcoin is more about being a liquidity barometer. And the fact that it is now back below 20,000 is meaningful. There are two very big consistency characteristics for Bitcoin that are now starting to come into focus. So the very first is that Bitcoin has had a really consistent trend. and it has never pulled back below a previous peak. Every time it has rebounded, or every time it's rallied, it's pulled back, gone sideways, and when it breaks out again, then it consolidates above the previous peak. And we've seen that every single time. So now we are back in the region of the peak from 2017, which the high was at 19,500. And the low in June of this year was at 17,599. So we have taken out the previous peak. And now the price is hovering here around 20,000. If we get a breakdown out of this range, well, then we are incontrovertibly breaking down into the underlying trading range. So that's a major trend inconsistency. Then we have the other big consistency characteristic. The reason that people get interested in Bitcoin, it's one because the price moves a lot and because they have a belief or a speculation in the future and the promise. But the most important of all is that it's limited supply. And the fact that the supply goes down once every 4 years is a really significant factor. So this has given way to this philosophical way of thinking that it does not matter what happens to the price. As long as you are willing to hold it for 4 years, you will come away with a profit. So this has created, in a very short period of time, the buy and hold way of thinking about this market. So this is what we're seeing now in Bitcoin, that people are willing to just get philosophical about it and buy and hold. So we're currently in September of 2022. So in September of 2018, the price was around at the 6,500 level. So we're still 3 times higher than it was 4 years ago. Of course, it doesn't mean that prices can't decline, but it's also worth considering that the high in June of 2019, which would take us into June of 2023, is going to be a lot closer to 14,000. So if Bitcoin just trends lower and comes back to 10,000 and spends a good deal of time around that level, well, then that's going to take out the other big trend consistency. And of course, Bitcoin has been running up into the law of big round numbers. So it got up to a market cap of more than a trillion. And a trillion's a lot of money. Even today, even with the sheer volume of money that's been printed for the last 20 years, a trillion is still a lot of money, and it requires a great deal of interest. So when we had this huge move up towards 70,000 and interest rates rising, it was inevitable that prices were going to start coming back down. But the big question today is whether higher interest rates will eventually kill off the consistency of the trend. And are we going to move then into a diminishing returns environment for Bitcoin? The next halving will probably be somewhere around 2024. And it's quite normal to anticipate a winter in the cryptocurrency markets before the halving. And we're only in 2022, so the next year could be exceptionally difficult for the cryptocurrency markets. Then it's likely there'll be a flood of activity when we come towards the next halving. But the other important point is that the halvenings in Bitcoin have generally coincided with massive floods of liquidity. So, the middle of 2020, we had one of the biggest surges of liquidity in history, and Bitcoin prices went absolutely wild. So, we are getting huge promises made in Bitcoin as well. But that does not mean that the price reflects when those promises will come to fruition. But you don't get a phenomenally large bull market like this without those promises coming true eventually. Then we have this other important characteristic. And I think Brookfield Asset Management has been among the most successful. So private equity companies have raised a phenomenally large amount of cash, and they're eager to deploy it. Blackstone did something that no one thought was possible during the aftermath of the credit crisis in 2008, and they bought thousands of homes, and they became one of the biggest landlords in the country. And of course, what it also did was it helped to support the property prices, and it gave control of rents to corporates. So then people found that their rents were rising every year, whereas that's not always the case when one finds a landlord that is willing to negotiate. The Wall Street algorithmic people are always going to want to raise the rent every year. And it contributed to a lot of disaffection and an inability for a lot of people to afford to get on the housing ladder. So we're definitely in an environment where private equity now has trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines waiting to intervene. And what is it that they're going to buy? Well, they're going to be looking for cash flows. And that's what a rental property represents. It's a cash flow. And it's a cash flow that has a rising dividend. Then we can think about companies that are going through difficult periods of time right now. 3M, for example, has pulled back in an exceptionally violent manner, and it's halved from where it peaked back in 2018. But this is also still a dividend aristocrat, and it yields at nearly 5%. So it's certainly the kind of company that could be purchased by private equity and trading on a PE that's approaching single digits. It's exactly these types of companies in a difficult market environment where we're almost certainly going to have a recession. Then liquidity is eventually going to hit consumers. We're already seeing the threat of that in the UK, and UK gilts surging higher. Consumers have been insulated from the massive acceleration in natural gas prices because of the price caps and the fact that those caps don't run off immediately. But the price is going to pop on the upside in the next 6 weeks, and mortgage rates are going to pop higher. So we can see in the UK an example of what we're going to witness in a number of other countries over the course of the next year, where mortgage rates and credit card bills, the interest-free finance is going to start running out. And I will say I availed of some of those interest-free finance deals back in April. I've never in my life had one. I didn't know how they work. And I have to say that when I got my statement, I found it absolutely incomprehensible. And I had to phone customer support and be walked through it step by step to identify when is it exactly that interest would become due. And I still had no faith that that was what was going to happen. So if And I've been working in the financial sector for 22 years, and if I was having that kind of difficulty understanding statements, I can only imagine what other people feel. So we're going to see consumer credit starting to become problematic. And This is going to start accelerating. The size of the Fed's balance sheet is rolling over, and it's going to accelerate lower over the course of or starting in September. They're going to shave $95 billion a month off of the size of the balance sheet. So, one thing that we know about balance sheet runoff is that it is deflationary in the sense of Milton Friedman, that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Well, this is a graphic example of that. We get an inflationary problem when we give people money directly, and particularly, and I mean, this was a clear fact in the USA that they gave people more money than they make from working. So it's a massive disincentive to work, and they are now going to create a recession to force people back into the workforce. But if you put money in, you get inflation. You take money out, you're going to get deflation. Now, of course, deflation could be that prices come back down. Deflation could also be that you get a big spike in unemployment and that companies go bust and that kills off demand in the economy. That's a different kind of deflation. But the one thing we know is that there were real fears of deflation in 2019 in the USA. And there was a real fear of deflation in Europe in 2014. And the one thing we know is that following these periods of balance sheet runoff, the deflationary fears are so large that central banks panic and they start reintroducing liquidity. So there's always going to be something that breaks. There's a well understood trend that they'll keep raising interest rates until something breaks. So that's potentially what we're looking at right now. So potentially it's going to be the leverage loans. Now, this is a total return index. And leverage loans have been a great place to invest for the last decade, particularly within the bond markets. We had a big drawdown in the middle of the year, we had a big rebound, and now it's rolling over again. So there was obviously a big problem in 2020, and it got better really fast. But let's just think then, just go back to one of the simplest lessons from the chart seminar. Big trends lose their consistency at the penultimate high. And we've had massive drawdowns in 2020, which broke through the 200-day moving average, broke through the 1,000-day moving average, and looked like a top and reversed within 3 weeks, and within a couple of months was at a new all-time high, and then saw another big move on the upside. But that's a major trend in consistency. So now we're rolling over. And we have inverted yield curves. So an inverted yield curve is a simple thing. It is that the short-term yield is higher than the long-term yield. And that means that if you're borrowing short and lending long, you're making a negative return. And that's basically banks. So banks don't make money when you have a negative real interest rate environment. And if they're not making any money, well, then they're less likely to lend it out. And the S&P 500 banks index is pulling back from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. This looks like a consistent downtrend. And then let's think about the regional banks in the USA. And they've also put in a lower high and are pulling back in a more violent manner. We've seen the Chinese banks already. So let's look at those European banks. And this is all of Europe. So European banks never really recovered. And they were in positive territory today, but Wall Street is finishing on the lows of the day. So The chances are that Europe is going to quickly reverse its rebound on Monday. And of course, the US market is closed on Monday for the Labor Day holiday. So we're seeing liquidity getting taken out of the market everywhere. And then we have currencies. And the yen is trending down, and the dollar is resurgent against it. So we're at significant new highs for the dollar against the yen. And taking out the peaks from back in 2001, we have to go all the way back to the 1980s to really see prices for the yen that were weaker than they are now. And the euro is back in the region of parity and still weak. So just about holding this area in here this week. Then you have the pound against the dollar is trending down, but at least against the euro, it has been holding up. But this was a very dynamic move that we had this week. So this is a really significant downward dynamic for the pound, and it is likely to go all the way back down and test the lower side of this range. It's not exactly that the euro is going to be the strongest currency in the world. So we are certainly looking at a bearish outcome. And I've been ruminating on Jeremy Grantham's call of a super bubble. And I do think that the tightening monetary conditions are the most important factor. That we've had high valuations and big promises made, and the prevalence of a buy and hold environment, the confidence that you always buy the dip and you always make money. Well, the potential is now that what we're seeing in the last 2 weeks is the buy the dip mentality failing. If the bull market is going to be sustained, then the Nasdaq 100 will absolutely have to find support in the region of the June low and then rebound and push back above the 200-day moving average. That's the minimum condition. And the continued strength of the dollar is a very significant factor because one thing is, of course, that the USA is an energy exporter. So gasoline prices popped on the upside, but they're coming back down. We saw that Russia cut off supply to Europe today, but US natural gas prices were in negative territory, down about 36 cents, and still way below the values in Europe. Now, I can't see natural gas coming down a lot if there's going to be an increasing demand for LNG and more, even more floating regasification plants all around Europe. But the US certainly has an energy advantage and is also exporting record volumes. So that's also positive for the balance of trade. So these are, I think, important factors that are contributing to the strength of the dollar. It's not simply that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates faster, but it also means that the economy is stronger and will require a higher interest rate to try and moderate that growth. And it looks like the Fed is going to do what's necessary for unemployment to rise. Now, unemployment did rise in today's announcement, but that was because participation increased. What I found interesting was that the commentary said that that was a good thing. But what it is probably more a reflection of is that people are being forced back into the workforce because they've run out of money. And if they're not going straight into employment, well, then that's going to contribute to rising unemployment. And of course, there is a mismatch between the jobs available and the workforce because there hasn't been any real increase in immigration for 3 years because of the of President Trump first shutting down immigration of highly educated workers, and then no willingness to re-amp it up. So we have large numbers of open positions and nobody to fill them. One thing as well, I think, is exceptionally important is the promise of semiconductors. So the promise was that these shares can only go up, that there's a chronic shortage, and they're the only companies that can produce them. So at there's just no way that those shares can go down. And particularly ASML, people have an almost religious affinity to the company, and that it's the sole supplier of this incredible equipment that makes semiconductors. And they have a pipeline of orders that stretches for years. And yet the share price is down from 750 down to 400 and now pulling back once more. The reality is that this semiconductor industry is cyclical. We tend to get these cycles where there is an acute shortage and everyone needs them now. We had exactly this in 1999, 1998 with Y2K. Then we had the pandemic. Everyone had to adopt the cloud immediately, and everyone needed to have a computer at home, and everyone needed to upgrade their computer because it just wasn't working or couldn't handle the video. And all of that contributed to outsized demand for chips. So we're getting this massive infrastructure cycle where capital investments have ballooned in an environment where global growth is slowing because there's these semiconductor fabs cost a fortune. And it's very likely they're all going to come online at the bottom of this cycle. And when we get to the top of the interest rate cycle, maybe 2 years or maybe 18 months from now, that's when all those semiconductor companies are going to start releasing new supply. You're going to have new factories opening up in the USA, Europe, China, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, all at the same time. And the market is going to be flooded with these chips. And that's going to be sharply deflationary. It's also going to provide a huge support for a recovery. So we generally tend to see these kinds of phenomena, triple waterfall crashes in the commodity sector and also in the semiconductors. And then we can think about what the recoveries are going to look like. There are going to be bankruptcies. There are going to be liquidations. There's going to be higher unemployment. And valuations are going to contract. And emerging market and European and Japanese currencies and commodity-related currencies are going to be cheap. And that's going to sow the seeds for the next big investment cycle. But the dollar is the linchpin, and the dollar remains exceptionally strong. And that's putting downward pressure on gold. So gold does well when you have negative real interest rates. But we've had negative real interest rates for a decade. And gold has been up and down a lot. So negative real interest rates are a necessary but not the only condition required for a big bull market in gold. You also need a weak dollar. And we haven't had a weak dollar this year. So prices came back from 2000 back down to 1700. Now, in the scale of things, that's a 15% decline, so it's not the end of the world. But the price is now in the region of the lower side of the range on the 1,000-day moving average. If the dollar continues to strengthen from here, it will put downward pressure on gold. When the dollar eventually rolls over, and if we still have negative real interest rates, which I believe is going to be the case, because the volume of debt outstanding hasn't gone away, and rising interest rates mean that it is going to be problematic. And we just haven't seen the problems arising yet because bankruptcies haven't continued or really haven't appeared. And that's all a factor of just how much money was floating around. The market for collectibles is still exceptionally strong. And I saw, I mean, I did mention it in one of the broadcasts early this week, it was a vase that had been broken and put back together in a shoddy manner, and people thought it would sell for about £1,000, and it went for 38,000. And that's an exceptional advance in an environment where liquidity conditions are tightening, which tells us that people still have cash. But high yield spreads are trending higher, and we are above 500 basis points. And it is when high yield spreads are above 500 basis points that we should expect problems. And we are starting to get problems. So it's not a time to get really greedy just yet. We're going to see some additional weakness. And there will be contagion. There will also be some exceptional buying opportunities over the course of this bear market. But we are still in a bear market. And it's really not until we see something break that the Federal Reserve will be really inclined to relent from raising interest rates. And that's particularly true as long as inflation is high and unemployment is low. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.